just so that we can keep moving forward. And we have a pretty light agenda, but we believe that it's going to be highly substantive. So we are looking forward to it. First thing I would like to say is, you know, as a part of our option, if members are unable to be here, they can always call in by telephone. And on the phone, we have Representative Atkins, Senator Reinhard, and Senator Miller, and Senator, co-chair Rosen is also going to call in. Excuse would be Senator Sharon, and I have Representative Hoppe as well. So from my understanding, excuse. Vice Chair Briner.
So, Chair Champion, I would like to just mention that Representative Atkins, while he had intended to be on the phone, I believe is on an airplane between D.C. and Chicago or some such, so he is not currently on the phone.
Well, thank you for that information. I'm sure that Representative Atkins was hoping that he could still be in transit and be able to use the phone in the air, you know? I know we're moving towards that, but we're not quite there yet.
Bad idea, Mr. Chair.
Oh, bad idea. Okay, thank you. With that being said, we are going to skip over the approval of the meeting minutes, and we're going to go to number four, which is the presentation from the Department of Administration on Force Facilities Agreement. And before us, we have Matt Bailey, who's from the Department of Admin. Welcome, and if you just state your name for the record, and you can go forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm Matt Bailey, Assistant Commissioner of Administration for the state. So we were asked to give, based on your discussion at the last meeting, a brief overview of the Minneapolis-St. Paul Entertainment Facilities Coordination Study. The Department of Administration is assisting the cities of St. Paul and Minneapolis in this effort. So we're the contracting agent for this project, and we're providing some oversight to the effort as well. Just briefly on page two, the study statutory authority, just a quick refresh of that. This study is intended to be completed by February 1st of next year. It is jointly funded by an appropriation to the Department of Administration and a combined matching appropriation or funding from the two cities. So each of us is pitching into that, and the cities have been helpful in getting that done. And just one other note on this, the language in the legislation was relatively prescriptive, so our RFP that we developed sort of mirrors that for the most part. Just briefly on the procurement process on page three, just wanted to give an overview of what we've done, where we've come thus far, and what the game plan is going forward. So in July and August, we began developing an RFP with the two cities, and in each of these steps, really, the state and both cities have been actively involved. We posted the RFP on September 3rd. We received four bids on October 7th and evaluated those again with formal evaluators from each of the three entities, executing a contract on November 5th. And began meetings the next day, which was relatively quick for us. So we were happy that all worked out. But we did have the contractor on the ground here the day after contract signature, and we began meetings with both cities and both facilities. Just in case people are interested, the four bidders are Barrett Sports Group, Stafford Sports, I'll come to them, they're the winning bidder, C.H. Johnson, and Convention Sports and Leisure International. On page four, a little bit about Stafford Sports. The team has spent a few days on the ground here in Minnesota, but we've spent some time on the phone as well. Really has a great background of very specific to this. This is not sort of a normal, just any consultants who've got sort of a general background kind of project. We really were looking for folks who understood the nuances of sports facility management. So each of the principals of Stafford and their subcontractors has more than 30 years of experience in managing venues and professional teams, New York, Philadelphia, Columbus, and elsewhere. In particular, they were, scored well and viewed as particularly useful because they're playing leadership roles in cooperative facility governance currently in Columbus, Ohio, and Greensboro, North Carolina, working with the authorities in those different cities. And those are some of the best examples we have out there of places where there used to be two different facilities. So in Columbus, they're 2 miles apart. You can see them from each other, but the Ohio State University built one facility with about 20,000 seats. Nationwide Center, managed by Nationwide, was nearby, also about 20,000 seats, and they were beating each other up on pricing there. So, this contractor had some very useful, specific experience in those kinds of areas. And they do have extensive experience with team, facility, and promoter personnel around the country. Again, you know, if I called Live Nation or, you know, one of the other promoters around the country, I wouldn't know what to ask, and they wouldn't know who I was. But, you know, having folks who know about these things and know how these contracts work, I think has been a real plus for us in this project. So in terms of the project timeline, we began gathering data and conducting interviews, as I said, in early November. We'll be continuing through that here over the course of the next several weeks, and Stafford is intending to start drafting that report. By mid-January, we're scheduled to have a draft, a sort of full draft of it, with it complete by the deadline at the end of January. Just a couple quick challenges that I think are worth talking about and, that we're thinking about. There is a lot of proprietary information involved in this, and that's been a concern, certainly, of the teams and the facilities. So we continue to work with them to figure out how we can gather what we need to gather from that information and, you know, incorporate it into the report without disclosing confidential, business-sensitive information that could cause either them to be, you know, less willing to participate or, you know, just to not give it at all. And I guess, you know, maybe the last point is a key relevant thing. The teams compete against each other. These facilities compete against each other because, you know, a concert can be held here versus here. The same, to some extent, the same company and fan base is competing between the two facilities. So there's sort of a historical challenge of getting folks to collaborate on these things. But I think we're certainly, you know, working well with the teams, and we're trying to figure out how much information we can get and you know, sort of how that affects what we're able to produce in the end. And then just lastly, the few other tested examples of this, I think this doesn't seem like rocket science, but it's a real challenge, and there aren't a lot of examples around the country where this has been successfully done. So we're excited that the Stafford team does have some specific examples of, you know, what happened in Columbus before and after those facilities were co-managed, what the financial impacts were of that, and so on. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Well, let me say thank you, first of all, Mr. Bailey, for coming today. And let's see if we have any other questions. Vice Chair Briner.
Thank you, Chair. I'm wondering, Assistant Commissioner, what I'm thinking of you, Bailey here, okay, about what we might know already from the existing agreements in Ohio and North Carolina. Have you looked at those? Do you yourself know what we might know about the competitive issues that they resolved through their cooperative facility agreement? You talked about the issue about proprietary information. They must have had the same type of issue to address. And I'm wondering if we know, we maybe have a model there of what they, you know, how they manage that issue.
Mr. Bailey.
Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair. You know, we have had some discussion with them. We do have sort of blacked out drafts of some of those agreements. That was part of the submission by the contractor to us, actually, as part of their proposal. So we've looked at it. I mean, they dealt with a lot of similar challenges. You know, we didn't talk specifically about how they got around the public data elements of it. The laws are somewhat different, you know, and certainly vary by state, so that may be part of that. But, you know, they went through a lot of challenges in terms of how to collaborate, how to work together. I think we've discussed some of the uniqueness of the challenges we have here. So just a couple examples. They have a pro team in one of those facilities, but not in the other. So somewhat different there. The two teams are located, I'm almost certain, in the same city. I know there's no history of competitiveness across city boundaries here between the two cities. You know, we have some sort of unique and longstanding differences. On the other hand, there's a lot of similarities to it. So
Any follow-up, Vice Chair Brenner?
Mr. Chair. Well, thank you. I think you're saying that details aren't really available to us now. I hope that when we get the final report, we might see some of that precedence. In order to have some assurance about the workability of a proposal, I would think we'd want to have as much detail as possible about what worked in these other two circumstances, if indeed those are the primary models available to us.
Mr. Bailey.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Vice Chair. Absolutely. I anticipate that a significant part of what we would come out with at the end is a real case study of the specifics of those two facilities, how they've worked, what the challenges are, and so on.
Any other questions for Mr. Bailey? Any other questions? Well, I'd like to say before he leaves, this particular section of our charge has really been spearheaded by Representative Davney as well as Senator Reiner, because we know that this issue was of major importance to them, and they're going to continue to be as engaged as possible. And the commission thought it would be important for all of us to get that information, seeing that we are such a small but yet workable group. So I just wanted to make sure that was stated. And thank you so much for your testimony today, Mr. Bailey. Thank you.
Thank you.
And now we can go back to number three, and I see that Chair Michelle Kemp-Helgen is here from the Stadium Authority, and we would love for her to come to the desk and give us an update. And I'm sure that the spark in her life is still burning brightly after the groundbreaking, and so we are very happy to have you. So welcome.
Thank you. First of all, let me apologize for being a few minutes late. I had a presentation to a group of senior citizens out in Chaska this morning, and as I drove back, I got caught in just probably some weather-related traffic. So sorry about that. All of a sudden, I was like behind a few trucks that were moving slowly, which I think is good at this point. So anyway, I'm glad to be here. As I understand it, you're looking for kind of a overview update of the project. So
yes.
What I'll do, I'm going to just touch on kind of an update on where we've been since I last was here. So we'll talk about the guaranteed maximum price and where that's at now that we've signed that agreement with Mortenson. I'll give you a brief update on the project schedule. And then if there's any other questions or things you'd like me to address, let me know. So that's kind of where I'll begin. A couple weeks ago at our last board meeting, Mortenson came in and provided their guaranteed maximum price. I think we had talked kind of at length about the fact that we had some budget challenges in that many of the subcontracts for pricing was coming in higher than what we had originally anticipated in our budget. So there was a lot of work that had to be done to get us obviously back into budget, knowing that there clearly is no additional public money available for this. So we worked with the team, Mortenson and the authority, and our architects to come up with savings in the project, and a lot of work was also done with individual subcontractors to get the best pricing we could on some of those. And in the end, as you probably noted through public accounts, the team actually stepped forward and put in some additional money so that some of the key elements within the project could move forward. And the hope is, as things go along, if there are savings out of the owners, the authority's contingency, that some of those items can be repaid to the Vikings. So it's unclear at this point what the final amount will be that they'll have to put in, but essentially what they have contributed sort of over and above what their original investment was, somewhere, depending upon how you define things, somewhere around $41 million. $26 million of that is actually a letter of credit for prepaying items that will be kept in the building, and that's against that. There could be some reductions depending upon if we have owner's contingency left. The other $15 million was actually costs from the University of Minnesota play that they're going to do that they've agreed to absorb in their own budget so that that money can be applied to the project. So in total, we're looking at that additional sum coming from the team, and we certainly, you know, that certainly made our budget adjustments much easier. However, I do think that all the valuable, all the kind of key elements that really make the design what we know it today have been kept in the building. So while we certainly made a lot of adjustments, primarily on like interior spaces, paint, carpet, flooring, finishes, and some design changes that the average person would never know was a change, but our architects were able to come up with some better, more efficient ways of doing things, for example, that save some money. So with that, we essentially got the budget back in line, and Mortenson was able to come in then with their what's known as the guaranteed maximum price. And that GMP is very important because from the authority standpoint and from the state standpoint who we represent, this is our guarantee that as long as we don't add additional things or make changes to the design, that essentially the design we currently have will be built by Mortenson within that $975 million budget. Essentially. So now the risk shifts really from the state to Mortenson Construction. So that's a big step, an important step. And I think from the state's perspective, they always anticipated that while they wanted the public side of things to be the developer, the owner, the operator, they wanted us also to minimize the state's risk to the greatest extent possible. So I think coming to this guaranteed maximum price, having Mortenson now in the driver's seat for the construction, to be at risk, it's, you know, CM at risk is essentially the model that we're using here, construction manager at risk, because Mortenson is essentially at risk to build the building within this budget. Again, as long as we don't make changes that will increase the cost. And obviously, from a public authority standpoint, we realize that we can't do that. And we will obviously live within the budget that now has been set. So the document, the guaranteed maximum price document that was signed between the authority and Mortenson is online. It's a public document. It's available for your review. I certainly can answer, you know, any questions related to that you might have. In addition to the budget being set through that, essentially the construction schedule and the completion date, all those key elements are also identified within that GMP document. And I'm just going to highlight a few of them because I think it also gives you an update and a sense of the schedule that we're looking at. Essentially, the commencement date with the GMP being signed, so we started construction then on November 22nd, 2013. And on the other end now, the substantial completion date that's in those documents is July 15th, 2016. The demolition of the Metrodome will begin right after our final game is played, which is December 29th. And once that takes place, essentially the disassembly of the interior will begin, and the demolition company will come in, and anything that is being saved, so to speak, will be taken out separately, taken out first, and then essentially, by the middle of the month, it will be the roof that's deflated and comes down. And once that happens, obviously, then anything that's left within the Metrodome at that point is basically just kind of there for salvage. So anything that will be saved, that will be kept or sold or used or whatever will have to be out within those first couple of weeks. and HKS will complete all the final detailed construction documents in May of 2014. So that's another kind of key date that comes. But essentially, that's the schedule. By mid-January, when the roof comes down, the power will be cut off to the stadium. And then really starting in February, the work will begin in earnest to build that superstructure, kind of with the first piece being the concrete. September 2014 through December 2015 will be the work on the enclosure, and a lot of it is dealing with the structural steel. You know, let me take 1 minute here to just talk a little bit about the steel that we're purchasing for this project, because I know there had been a lot of public discussion and public questions and concerns when Mortenson did their GMP. They mentioned the fact that for that very large truss that was being built, there was some high-grade steel that had to be purchased from Luxembourg that was going to be used. And that, of course, given the very clear intention of the legislature and the governor to have as much, obviously, material coming from Minnesota, or at least domestically, as well as business to go to Minnesota firms, there was a lot of concern about this. So I just want to take a minute and kind of highlight the details of that for you to make sure we clarify. Our total steel budget, if you will, is about $82 million. And of that $82 million, that includes the purchase of the manufactured steel. It includes the fabrication that will all be done here in Minnesota. And it also includes the erection of the steel. So that total budget is $82 million. And of that $82 million, $5 million of it is what is needed to be purchased in this high-grade steel. And essentially what it is, it's a grade 65 steel that it's a lot stronger, sturdier, that's being used for a portion of that truss that has to hold up the roof. It's material that is not, this grade of steel is not manufactured domestically. It's only a small portion of the steel that will be purchased and used for the building, and it obviously is a very small portion, like 6% of the entire steel if you include fabrication and erection and that kind of thing. Lejeune Steel is the company that's doing the steel work that will be purchasing the steel. They're a Minnesota-based company. And the company that is actually in Luxembourg that this high-grade steel will be purchased from actually has two plants up on the range here in Minnesota. So there is at least some indirect connection, if you will, with the Minnesota company from the standpoint that they do provide significant jobs and economic activity here in our state. But the plant that manufactures that particular grade of steel is in Luxembourg. I can answer any other questions about that later or at this point if there are any, but I just wanted to make a particular point of going through and explaining that because I know there was a lot of questions surrounding that after our last board meeting. So I just mentioned that. So mid-November 2014 is when a major piece of that truss superstructure will be put in place. There'll be in July next summer, and this is kind of a big event for folks, is this tower crane that's going to be used to really move these very heavy steel parts is going to be coming to Minnesota. There's like three of these cranes that in the world that you have to rent, so to speak. And we've got one of those cranes reserved, and it will be coming in July of 2014. It comes literally in 100 truckloads, and then it's assembled here on site. and it can lift up to 300 tons of steel at a time. I mean, it's just amazing. So I think it's going to be an interesting process, just given this building is quite unique in terms of the design and the engineering of the whole thing, and I think it could provide some interest for the public as the thing proceeds. And then, you know, 2015 is when the enclosure begins and the interior work starts and the ETFE goes on. And 2016, obviously, is when the interior finishes really get underway. And then it will be the opening, as we mentioned, in July of 2016. We're right now going through a process of Mortenson letting out all the subcontracting bids, and then within those major subcontractors, they will in turn subcontract major pieces to a lot of other smaller Minnesota firms. And I think at maybe one of our next meetings, it would be good to give you, right now they're just finalizing a lot of those sort of tier one subcontracting contracts, but every contract that is signed has our women businesses and minority targeted businesses goals that they have to adopt. All those subcontractors are on board to meet those objectives, but we'll have a lot more information here in the next few months that we can give you on Minnesota firms, the amount of work going to Minnesota firms, and the amount of work going to women and minority targeted business firms, which again, all must be Minnesota firms as well. But I will tell you, so far as those subcontracts are going out, I think probably the most significant good decision we made on this project was to have Mortenson Construction as the construction firm, because, you know, having a Minnesota company, you know, clearly there's only three or four of these companies across the world really that do this major stadium construction work. All of them are very competent, but having a Minnesota firm that was up there in that group of three or four and all the ties that they have to other Minnesota companies, it really isn't even much of an issue because their relationships are so interwoven and strong in the community that the bids we're getting are largely all from Minnesota company, you know, a lot of the subcontracting bids and really the best competitive bids are coming from our Minnesota firms. Our board feels very strongly that this is about Minnesota jobs and the Minnesota economy. And it's clearly is being carried on through the bids and the subcontracting work that's being done through Mortenson and all of their partners. So we'll have more detail on all that and can give you, I think, a very thorough update on that in a couple of months. And I think it'll be, you know, we obviously are going to be tracking all this and reporting it in a lot of different venues. But I imagine that's something that this committee will care about, given the focus that you've had in the legislation to meet those goals. And of course, you know, coming up now, starting in January, there'll start to be workforce being hired, and we'll be tracking and measuring the workforce and how we meet the targeted workforce goals as well. So we can keep you apprised of all that as time goes on. That's all I really had from an update standpoint, but I obviously can provide more information or answer any questions.
Thank you so much. Any questions for Chair Kim Helgen? Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one quick question on the $41 million you referenced that the Vikings are putting forward. So can they recoup 100% of that? Or is that just in the, if there were savings to the project, how can that be done?
Yeah, it would
Chair
be.
Chair Kim Helgen.
It would be, thank you, Chair. It would be done through $26 million of the $41 million could potentially be recouped. But it only comes in relationship to our contingency. And right now, the authority's contingency is actually down to $30.4 million, I believe. So our total contingency budget that's left or that's there is $30 million. Clearly, we are, and the contingency is meant just as we see it and know it for things that are unexpected. And within our development agreement, there's what's known as the contingency release schedule. So there are certain key dates in the project as our risk is diminished, as we hit milestones in the project and we know, okay, fine, we've got all that subcontracting work bid, for example, and we know that we're within budget. Check it off the list. There might be $3 million in contingency that can be released at that point. So there's a schedule with the final not being released until the very end of the project. Clearly, in any project of this size, there will be things that happen that we'll need contingency for. I mean, that's what it's there for. So I am certain that they will not recoup $26 million. They will never recoup the full amount, and they know that. On the other hand, will some amount be left? Perhaps. There also are additional things, we've talked about this, that are kind of that are specifically identified as ad alternates that would be brought back into the project, an extra set of escalators, an additional freight elevator. There's a whole list of those things. And some of that contingency money, the authority also gets to, as contingency money is released, we identify a portion of that for things that are essential to the project to come back in. So from that standpoint, the full $26 million would not be available. So even as contingency dollars are released, some of it could go to reduce the Vikings letter of credit. But there's a very clear list of things, and there's a very clear priority that the authority would have to use that contingency money that is left to bring it back into the project. So between those, you know, just contingencies that happen that we need to cover, and then things that we need to include in the project, which I will say the team also agrees that these things are of the highest priority. So adding that extra set of escalators, adding that additional freight elevator, those in particular are two things that I think the team and the authority agree that if there is, you know, as that first contingency release comes, that's probably the first priority to fund back in the building rather than reducing their letter of credit. So I'm certain that they will not get 26 back. It's unknown how much they will, and it could be a fairly small amount. And they're prepared to cover that. They realize that. The only reason I always make that explanation, I don't in any way want to purport, because some of that money could come back. We just don't know. So I want to be clear that there's not a misunderstanding. It's not like guaranteed they're putting that full amount in, but clearly there will be a certain amount that will not go back to them.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair Barnum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This really isn't related to your report, Michelle, but I wondered if, since we have the time, if you could speak to what you know about the proposed energy systems that may be installed in the facility. Has that been discussed at all at this time? I guess that's my question.
Chair Kim Helgen.
You know, I know it has been discussed. I personally am not up to speed on the details of any of that. I know that there's a big question about we currently are hooked into the Hennepin County energy system for our hot water and heating and cooling, and I know their current system is not large enough to handle this building. So there's been a lot of discussion about different options that could be looked at, either that Hennepin County would upgrade their facility or we'd use something else. But I have to be honest, I will add that to the list to update you at the next meeting, because anything I would be talking about would be very unclear.
Any other questions? That's my understanding. I saw in the news that you guys were talking about the 64,000 seats that are in the Metrodome right now, and you were exploring, you know, options as to what to do with those seats. Any other updates around that?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because that is, and I'd like to, you know, I'm definitely soliciting input on this, because it's going to be a fairly major challenge. We have been keeping lists of all the, and again, I make a distinction. There's some private individuals and private groups that have asked about, you know, wanting a couple of seats or wanting even groups of seats. There's some private entities that want to buy. That's one thing. And, you know, if we can accommodate it and they pay for those seats and, you know, whatever, that's fine. The group I'm most concerned about is we've got a pretty healthy list. I just had somebody go through it yesterday. There's about, and again, I'm doing this somewhat from memory, but I just asked for the information yesterday. So there's about 70 schools, colleges, nonprofit like community centers and baseball groups, that kind of thing, that have made inquiries for seats. And the total, most of the groups have asked for like 200 to 300. There are some that have asked for more. I know there was, for example, one school that had been hit by a tornado, I believe, and they are looking for more. And here's where we're at with this, and it's really become, you know, to me, in my mind, it's like, well, first of all, obviously we want to reuse them if we can. It's a public resource for those schools and community groups and baseball groups. Let's definitely do it. But here's the issue that we're confronted with. First of all, and we need to be very clear with everyone what it is they're getting. These seats are bolted into concrete slabs. There's no base. They don't sit on anything. So if you don't have concrete or wood or, you know, some sort of riser to bolt them into, you can't use them. That's one thing. Second of all, because of the way they're mounted and they share chair arms and that kind of thing, it's really difficult and expensive to, number one, remove them, and number two, to separate them in groups. Some are 10 seats long, some are 4, and they're all different configurations. So that's part of it. So what we talked to Mortenson about, we said, okay, because the demolition company, of course, their intention is to come and demolish, right? And so the question is, what is the cost to remove these in terms of having workers come in, unbolt them, separate them, move them out? And we thought, okay, they could put them at the loading dock for those. We could look at who we have orders from or requests from with these groups. We could put them at the loading dock, and then we, of course, would have to have, Mortenson would have to have staff to get them into trucks, and, you know, there's insurance and liability issues. But we've come down to the point now where Mortenson is basically saying, when you look at labor costs and the what's being done, they're looking at $48 a chair to remove these is their initial take on it, which to me seems high, and we can maybe get it down some. When you look at that $48 a seat, and then you start looking at, so far we've got requests from these public groups for about 20,000 seats total, and then you multiply that, like our authority can't absorb $1 million cost to remove chairs. Charging these groups, I mean, no school, these things new are probably worth, I think they're like $150 if you bought one of these seats new. So they are, you know, new, they're valuable. But a third of that cost, even for used seats, just gets to be too much probably for these groups. So we're just now starting to think and talk and try to figure out how to do this. We obviously, if we could, in some sort of efficient way, remove them and reuse them and that kind of thing, that would clearly be our intention. But as an authority, we obviously don't have those kind of funds to absorb in terms of the cost to remove and break them apart and, you know, make them somewhat usable. And then, of course, we want to make sure that all these schools and groups know that they're not freestanding seats, that they'd have to build some sort of platform for the base of them. So that's what we're struggling with, and I'd be glad for input to that because it's a challenge.
Representative Devaney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair. I got a couple ideas on chairs, but I'll talk to you later. That was a segue that I wasn't intending. It does beg the question, though, of are there targets as to how much of the existing stadium is recycled, repurposed, re-something, and how much will end up in landfills or waste recovery systems?
Mm-hmm. Chair Kim Helgen.
Yes. Again, I can get you information on that. I do know that the demolition company has very detailed plans for a lot of recovery and recycling, things that, you know, the copper wire. I mean, there's a lot of things within that building that is somewhat valuable. All those things, when they made their bid for demolition, were taken into account, that the things that could be reused and recycled reduce the cost of their demolition bid, and they will recover that cost. But it was within those bids, and we had a number, and again, I don't know the exact details of this. I know we had a number of demolition bids that, when I say we, it's Mortenson, that they looked at. This was definitely the most competitive bid, but all of them looked at the reuse of a certain amount of those materials. And I can get you the answer to what it is. I don't happen to know that off the top of my head.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, I'd be interested, and I think the public would be interested to see what was available for reuse, what was being recycled, and what was going to end up in landfills.
Sure.
So I'd appreciate the information. Thank you.
And we have, I think,
Chair Kim Helgen.
People do know, Mr. Chair, if I could just add that we have already been putting things on the Department of Administration auction site to any things that weren't necessary for the completion of the football season that could already be disposed of. And we're getting rid of those things through the public auction process. So,
Chair, as pertains to the chairs, what about the possibility of groups who have been identified as those who are interested coming in and removing them chairs themselves? Do you foresee any liability or any challenge with that? Can you speak to that as a possibility to deal with the underlying labor cost?
Yeah. I mean, we looked at that because that obviously, if you could just say to people, if you want 200 chairs, you know, we'll have somebody there to supervise. As you can well imagine, our insurance company and just the work rules, you know, we're governed by a labor peace agreement and sort of how all those things interact. But mainly it's the insurance and liability issue that we just couldn't go there, you know, to have all these people come in. And again, when you think about these chairs and they have to be like soldered apart, I mean, it's not just unbolting a few things. It's a very significant process.
What I was
and
thinking
not of, one you'd want someone who didn't really know what they were doing undertaking.
What I was thinking about, as well as volunteers, but maybe even nonprofits like Network for Better Futures or some sort of organization who has labor at a discounted rate, for lack of a better word, but giving them something to do. But again, if you guys could consider to think about that and be creative, that would be very useful. Because we wouldn't want to foresee all those wonderful chairs that has great memories just go to waste and then end up in some landfill or something when it could potentially have been, honored in some other way. Any other questions for the chair? And just so that folks know, we do have some legislators on the phone as well, so I want to make sure that I give them an opportunity to ask a question if they have one. Any questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Senator Rosen.
Yes, thank you. I do have a question for Michelle, Chair Kelhelgen. I'm passing somebody right now. I'm
going to get to it.
Chair, when we were looking at the existing site, and there was a discussion about the infrastructure savings costs by using the existing site of the Metrodome to put the new dome on, Do you have an idea, or has there been much discussion on what can be used? Has that come become a reality as far as cost savings using the existing site?
Chair Kim Helgen, did you hear this question okay?
Yes.
Yes.
Chair Rosen, as I understand it, originally there was talk about a proposal that had some reuse of the existing Metrodome. But I think in the end it was determined that that was more expensive than just kind of starting from scratch. I do know that the main thing that has been helpful is the fact that a big portion of the hole, if you will, has already been dug. And so the amount of digging while the new stadium is much larger than the old one, and there certainly is a lot of additional foundation that has to be dug. Probably your biggest savings is the fact that, you know, once you remove the concrete and, you know, everything from the old dome, you've got the hole at least 60% of the way dug. And so I believe that's probably the biggest a positive that we have. Was there anything else that you're thinking about?
Well, just in line with Mr. Chair, excuse me.
Senator Rosen.
In line with Representative Reinhardt's question, too, is that what kind of energy you're going to be using? But the basic infrastructure, is there some of the infrastructure costs, have they been mitigated because you're using an existing site that already has the infrastructure in place? I'm not sure if it's possible to get the cost savings on using an existing site besides the whole, but the utilities, anything that needs to go into that Metrodome, is it being used again for this new building?
Chair Kim Helgen.
I know the basic, like, heating and cooling systems cannot be used. They're way undersized for what we're doing. And the other thing is, anyone who's taken a recent tour of the Metrodome, literally a lot of this infrastructure, because it is 30 years old and we're looking at the original, I mean, it's, in literal terms, some of it is held together with duct tape. So, you know, most of that is being, you know, redone. I certainly will check to see, though, and find out. I'm sure there are certain things that are being reused, and I'm not real familiar with the details of that. So we can check on that and get back to you. It would be interesting to know.
And I think there was someone else on the telephone who wanted to ask a question. Senator Miller or anyone else there?
I'm still here, but no question.
All right. Any other questions from anyone around the table? Any other member? Well, that seems to have
thank
done
you.
It. So thank you so very much, Chair Kim Helgen. So we need to approve the minutes. Is there anyone who's willing to look at the minutes and make a motion for approval of the minutes from October 24th and November 7th meeting?
I'll make a motion, Mr. Chair.
All right. Senator Housley has made the motion to approve the minutes from October 24th and October and November 7th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Correction?
Well, Mr. Chair, we have a quorum, and are we able to approve the minutes?
I believe so. Let's see. How many other people?
Oh, wait. 12 members and five. Okay. Yep.
Sorry.
So we will not approve the minutes, so we will do that next time. Thank you so much, Vice Chair Briner. Any other questions? I see Lester Bagley here. Thank you so much for being here. And we know that we don't have any oversight of the Vikings, but we want to say congratulations for the groundbreaking. Anything else?
Yes, sir.
All right. Then meeting adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What was the